Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody to House Resources. It is Wednesday, March 28th, and it is about 1:10. And present are Representative Wilson, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Gardner, Co-Chair Feige, Co-Chair Seaton. Remind everybody about their cell phones. Today we're going to be holding an overview and discussions on decoupling of oil and gas taxes. We also, under bills previously heard, first of all, I'd like to bring up House Bill 328, which is separate accounting, and we're bringing it up for the purpose of looking at a committee substitute, which Representative Wilson, would you?
Yes, I move CS for House Bill number 328, Resources, version I, before the committee for...
Is there a working document?
Yeah, as a working document.
Okay. Seeing no objection, version I is before the committee. Just to let the committee and the public know, what this version does is address issues that were brought up by industry and by the Department of Revenue relating to such things as the way depreciation works instead of using the 1981 depreciation schedule, this current version would use a current federal tax depreciation schedule so that companies wouldn't have to file their federal depreciation schedules and then go back and recalculate all their deductions based on the 1981 law, which is the current way. It also changes from the from industry submitting its data to revenue and then revenue calculating to the tax as it was back in 1978 to the mechanism which we use now, where the industry follows the regulations and rules, calculates our own corporate income tax, and then that is audited by the Department of Revenue. It also sets out quarterly filings, and it sets out penalties for failure to file. It also has an exemption from the quarterly filings for those with less than $1 million tax liability in a year, so that they could do annual filing. Those are the main changes that were addressed in here from our previous hearing. And so if people will, at future hearings, if we're talking about this bill, if they would address their comments to version I, that would be posted on the website. So we're going to now go to the overview, and just to let everybody know, on Friday we will have HB 91, which is management of forest resources, and we'll have up again HJR 40, which is the RS 2477 right-of-ways, and any bills previously heard. Anything to come before the committee before we do? For everybody's information, at 1:30, I have a bill up on the other side, so Representative Co-Chair Feige will be taking over the meeting at that point. And seeing nothing else, we'll have the Department of Revenue come forward. And thank you. And before you introduce yourself, I just wanted to let the committee know that we have online from Anchorage with the Department of Revenue, Matt Fonder, Lenny Dees, John Larson, Sherry Niehaus, and Mike Redlinger. And so I believe I'm pronouncing those names right. If I messed them up, sorry. But anyway, you know Deputy Commissioner who's on. So would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Co-Chair Seaton. My name is Bruce Tangeman, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. With me is Dan Stickle, Acting Assistant Chief Economist. Today we're here to present an overview on the issue of decoupling. This was certainly a large topic of discussion a few sessions back, and we were asked to give an overview to catch everybody up on the issue, to refresh their memories, assuming it's going to be a part of the discussion going forward. We'll start off with a slide.
And just for the committee's reference again, just to make sure everyone knows, we don't have any particular bill before us that does decoupling in any particular way. We're, as the deputy commissioner said, we've asked them to come and present the general issue because we may see it in some form.
Thank you. We'll be talking briefly about the production tax and how it works. This is an overview of the overview we did last week in this committee, so we won't spend too much time on this.
Okay, and before we do, I need to recognize Representative Dick and Representative Foster have joined us, and that about 2:30, Representative Wilson will have to depart.
We'll also talk about what is decoupling, why decouple, some of the issues that have come up around, surrounding decoupling, and then a brief history of SB 305, which was the decoupling bill back in 2010. Slide 3 is a brief walkthrough of how the production tax works. We went into quite a bit more detail than this last week, but just a refresher. It is company specific. It's based on production tax value, and in order to get to production tax value, you start with the market price less transportation costs, otherwise known as the gross value at point of production. You then deduct lease expenditures, both operating and capital, to get to the production tax value. Another point is BOE, barrel of oil equivalent, which will be interspersed throughout this presentation. Once you get to the PTV, that's where the tax rate calculation begins. You have your base rate of 25%, and then the progressivity applies when the PTV is over $30 a barrel of oil equivalent, and increases at a rate of 0.4% for each dollar of PTV over that $30. A quick example of how this works: at a PTV of $50 a barrel of oil equivalent, the tax rate would be 33%, and how you get there is the 25% on the first $30 and then 0.4 on the next $20. Add them together, 33%.
And currently, are we thinking that a PTV of $50 is about?
I generally use about $30 extra, so about $80 of oil price.
Okay, the $50 example would be 80 ANS West Coast.
Yes, sir.
And the 9250 would be 120.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
At PTV of 9250, the progressivity changes to 0.1 per $1 of PTV. Slide 4 is a familiar slide from last week also. This is the income statement. Look, that is included in the revenue sources book. I won't walk through that again, but that is a good good picture of how all of this is calculated on a high level. Slide 5, we start talking about decoupling. What is decoupling? Under current law, gas production from major gas sales would be converted to barrel of oil equivalent and taxed in the same calculation as oil. Current law equates 6 million British thermal units, or BTUs, to one barrel of oil. Decoupling would calculate oil and gas tax for major gas sales separately. Slide 6 is a simple way to look at coupled versus decoupled. On the left-hand side is how it is currently calculated. You have oil and gas destination value minus the transportation cost, which would get you to the gross value point of production, minus The lease expenditures get you to the PTB, multiply the tax rate that's applicable to get you to the tax liability. On the right side is the exact same calculation. It would just be done for gas and oil separately. So that's the concept that we're dealing with when talking about decoupling. Slide 7, why decouple? Oil is different than gas, obviously different uses, different resource endowments, different substitutes. Decoupling allows tax policy to be crafted specific to oil or gas production. Oil is currently worth more than gas by a wide margin today. And gas value relates to oil, referred to as parity, varies greatly over time. Currently, oil is bumping around $120 a barrel. Gas is around $2.20 per million BTU.
Now, would we be... We talk about oil at 120, and we talk about gas at 250 or 220 or something. However, any gas sales that we have are either in Cook Inlet, which are much higher than that, or on the North Slope, and I'm not sure what that amount is. Is that tied to Henry Hub? Because I know the reason people are considering sales of gas to as LNG to Asia is because it's not 225 or 250 in MCF. So when we're doing this relationship, do we have different mechanisms where we're tying that so that we're not always comparing Henry Hub, which we don't tie to, a comparison with Japan or China or Korea or something?
I believe it's based on the market price. It's just that it's such a small quantity that we're dealing with now internally. So when we're talking about the LNGs or even the Alberta route, we're talking about, you know, 4.5 billion cubic feet a day. So the market rate would prevail even today in state, but it's such a small quantity that's why it's not a huge issue in the state today.
Okay, well, we sell 270 million cubic feet a day or 240 million cubic feet a day into the pipeline and electricity grid in South Central. But it's not tied to Henry Hub, I don't believe. So I guess what I'm trying to do is figure out as we go forward with these discussions, if we come into talking about gas and oil, it wouldn't be appropriate to pick a market that we're not in that happens to be the lowest market in the world for gas, which is Henry Hub, and, you know, the highest price oil. I would like to see as we go forward not just that comparison. I'd also like to see that comparison based on if we were exporting gas to Asia someplace, what the comparative values are. I'm not saying anything wrong. I'm just saying that
right.
When we're getting our head around this, we have to also look at what are these looking like in the markets that we would probably play, presuming AGEA through Alberta is not going to be the route as well.
So. And certainly we will, as if a bill appears before this committee, we will certainly put it in more real time with more realistic numbers. Further back in this presentation, we look at some different parities.
Okay.
So we look at the 6-to-1 and the 8-to-1 and 15-to-1 and today's, which is 50-to-1 probably. So while we'll talk about, you know, the current rates, really any major gas sale down the road is going to have to assume a lot higher price than $2.18 per MCF. So
thank you. Representative Wilson.
So when you talk to us and give us examples, are you using ANS prices, or what prices are you using when we're dealing with things right now?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we are using ANS,
okay,
West Coast, for oil, and we're using Henry Hub for gas.
Oh. Okay. Good to know. Okay.
And turning the gavel over to Co-Chair Feige. I have to leave. I will return shortly, hopefully. You never know how those short days go.
Let's see, where were we? Slide 8. Oil price is not 6-to-1 of gas price. I think during the discussions back in, in the earlier part of the decade, there were times when 6-to-1 was a relative parity and where the discussion should have been centered. But if you notice on the chart, there aren't many times when 6-to-1 was relevant, and certainly since January of 2006, it's steadily climbed to where it is today. So that's one of the biggest issues we face now when dealing with decoupling, is oil is worth so much more than gas on the market right now. Slide 9, why decouple? Including lower value gas in the same tax calculation as higher value oil reduces the average value per BOE and therefore reduces the progressive tax rate on oil. This is known as the dilution effect. Obviously, we're not realizing large sale or large volume gas sales at this point, so it's not an issue today. But by taxing oil and gas together, gas production would reduce oil taxes, even though oil operations are unaffected. This has been called the flip the switch problem. So as soon as we do realize a major gas sale, state revenue could drop significantly under certain price scenarios, including current price scenarios.
Thanks, Bruce. I know that we don't have a lot of gas sales, but can you just give us sort of a rough estimate of the amount we're, I guess, currently losing now? What's our economic impact now? And then if we do have a 4.5 BCF line, what that impact could possibly be?
I'm doing an address right now.
Representative Kawasaki through the chair. What we did is we looked at the 2011 year, and we found that the reduction in state revenue from oil due to including gas from Cook Inlet and North Slope sales in the progressivity calculation was on the order of about $80 million. And going forward, we're looking at probably $100 to $150 million a year from that. And then the next several slides jump into a few examples on what it could look like with a 4.5 BCF line.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
So slide 10 is where we lay out some assumptions for the following three or four slides where we will talk about some of the different scenarios. It is a one-year income statement model like we've shown earlier in the presentation. We do use Department of Revenue 2012 profiles, and we use 450,000 barrels of oil a day, 4.5 billion cubic feet of gas a day. We start with the conversion of 6 MCF equals 1 barrel of oil. And the cost allocation assumptions we use is $2.5 billion in OPEX, $2.5 billion in CAPEX, and cost split on the basis of gross value at the point of production. We also assume transportation costs for oil of $11 a barrel and gas $4.50 per million BTU.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bruce, I don't mean to slow you down, but I'm just having a little on slide 10, left side conversion. 6 MCF equals 1 BOE. And as I look up here, BOE is after the lease expenditures, transportation, all the other stuff, right? So it's, help me understand.
The Representative Dick through the chair, BOE doesn't really have anything to do with where it falls in the income statement. the 6 MCF equals 1 barrel of oil equivalent. So it's got nothing to do with...
But that's in terms of BTUs.
For clarification, Representative Dick, 1 MCF is roughly equal to 1 million BTUs also. I think it's 1.0013 or something like that.
Okay, one MCF is equal to...
1 million BTUs.
Okay, but I'm struggling here. Please be patient. Okay, but the BOE is just 44 gallons. At 60 degrees, it's, 14.65 PSI, right? So that's correct then. Okay, so BOE is not referring to cost. The comparison, are we comparing dollars? Are we comparing BTUs?
Representative Dick, through the chair, the purpose of putting that conversion on the slide was just to state a modeling simplification that we used for purposes of preparing the scenarios on the next several slides, where we have where the tax is assessed and progressivity is calculated on a barrel of oil equivalent basis. What is the conversion factor that we used to calculate our 4.5 BCF a day of gas to barrels of oil equivalent? And we simply use the 6-to-1 ratio, where in reality it might be 5.9 or 6.1. It's a modeling simplification.
Okay, through the chair, if you don't mind. But okay, I'm just trying to clarify here. I'm a little bit behind, but my question is, are we comparing the dollar ratio, or are we talking BTU ratio, 6-to-1?
BTU. If you go back to slide 5, okay. Mm-hmm. The way the law is currently written, they're the middle bullet. Okay. Our law equates 6 million BTUs to 1 barrel of oil.
So it would be the heating value.
Okay, current law.
That's how a barrel of oil equivalent is legally defined.
Okay.
Okay. And then back on slide 10, well, there's what you have to know is that an MCF and a million BTUs are about the same.
Yeah. Okay. I understand that was good. There was good comparison for. Okay, let me process this and I'll come back. Thank you.
All right. Slide 11 is the first of several scenarios that we're going to present. And in this slide, we're looking at a high parity rate. Decoupled revenue is greater than status quo. Oil price of $120 a barrel and gas of $8 per million BTU. So this would equate to a 15-to-1 parity.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. What's the difference between oil standalone, gas standalone, and decoupled? Aren't they essentially the same?
Dan, would you like to? Yeah, Representative Gardner, through the chair. In this slide presentation, they are essentially the same. What we've done in setting up these charts is we've allowed the ability, as any proposal moves forward, to potentially have a status quo, an oil standalone, and gas standalone, and then a third bar that is a different proposal that would allow you to compare three scenarios.
Thank you. Okay, but looking ahead, and I've looked at the three charts and the different scenarios that you've got going here, for our purposes, at least here today, they're really the same.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you've used these numbers, the 120 a barrel and 8. Have you done the calculation for the 30-to-1, or even more than 30-to-1 parity that we've got right now?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the last slide we knew was at today's rates, which is 55-to-1.
Yeah.
Okay. So that'll be the extreme comparison.
And Representative,
I'm sorry. At high parity, just explain to me what you're talking parity means right here.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, parity is the comparison of how oil and gas relate. So 6-to-1 is the parity that was
basically being discussed several years ago. And the parity has grown and grown as oil's gotten worth more and oil is, or gas has decreased in value.
Or statutes on the table. Just a little.
So the charts, as Representative Gardner pointed out, the oil standalone and the gas standalone are the same as the decoupled bars throughout this presentation. But this shows the delta between the status quo, the way it's calculated now together. And again, this is 400,000 barrels of oil a day and 4.5 billion cubic feet of gas per day. So if they were calculated together under status quo, the revenue would be 4.1 billion. Decoupled, it would be 5.9, and then in the far right, you see the delta of the calculation between the two.
So in other words, the companies blanket coupled together because because they're not paying as much, right?
Through the chair, it sure looks like it.
Yeah, I have a question about why you've used the 450 thousand barrels a day versus where we're at right now currently.
Sure. Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, the 450,000 barrels a day represents roughly where we expect oil production to be about a decade from now, given our fall forecast.
So the point was, it wouldn't be realistic to present it with today. We use our fall forecast and the production forecast that we use there. And in order to be as realistic as possible, we took the production decline and what it would look like in 10 years, assuming it would take 10 years to ramp up to realize 4.5 BCF of gas flow.
And
in other words, it would take 10 years to build a pipeline.
So do you also anticipate the price of a barrel of oil being $120 and gas being at $8?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we don't make any assumptions. We could use our fall forecast, but the purpose of this presentation is to show several different scenarios, this being one of them. I would guess $120 might be close to what we're showing 10 years out, actually.
Really?
Which is actually today's price. So I do know we show a fairly flat oil price into the future.
ANS West Coast in 2021 would be 117.31.
Okay. In the ballpark.
Thanks.
I think that was coincidental.
No, that's why we picked it.
All right, continue, please.
Slide 12. We still use $120 a barrel for oil, the same production numbers of 450,000 barrels of oil, 4.5 BCF of gas. However, in this slide, we use a gas price of $15 per MMBTU, which would equate to a parity of 8 to 1. As you can see, the total revenue is significantly higher in all cases. However, the status quo of 9.8 and the decoupled amount of 10.3, the delta is 0.5, and that's much closer together. And that's because the oil price and the gas price are getting closer to that 6.1 parity level, which in essence is a break-even amount. So we're bringing up the gas price in this scenario to be a little more equal to the oil price. In slide 13 is that scenario where we show $90 a barrel and gas at $15 per MMBTU. So we get to the 6-to-1 parity. In this scenario, we drop the oil price a little bit to get there instead of bringing the gas price up even more. But as you can see, the status quo revenue would be $7.1 billion. Decoupled would be approximately $7.1 billion. So this is where revenue would equal the same, either status quo or decoupled. Slide 14 is at today's price. So we show the $120 a barrel for oil, the $2.18
per MMBtu for gas, which equates to a 55-to-1 parity. Status quo of $1.3 billion decoupled would show an increase of almost $2.7 billion in revenue. And we'll talk a little bit later about what's driving these numbers and why the calculations change so much among the different parity levels.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Herron.
Commissioners, do you have a slide? Maybe not in this PowerPoint presentation where it's at 150, 160 oil.
Through the chair, Representative Herron, we don't have anything in this presentation. We haven't prepared anything specific, but our model is set up to run any scenario that's conceivable. So
the reason I ask is, of course, I wasn't in the legislature when they did ACEs, but weren't those forecasts based on the high end? Wasn't that based on 100, 120?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I don't recall what the Do you recall what the prices were during the ACES debate?
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of different price points models.
Mr. Chairman, but the high ones, that's what I'm interested in. Was it based on 80, 100, 120 of the scenarios that the legislature and the administration talked about then?
We can pull up some of the ACES presentations from that discussion, but we don't know the number.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's, I mean, you know, from what I understand, ACES, during those debates, nobody in their wildest dreams that we'd be talking about 150. And now, future speculators are banking on 150. So why don't we have observations or things that are 150, 160, 170, 180? Because given the greed by the speculators, those might be realistic numbers.
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I agree. I believe, you know, the price of oil was around $60 back then, and they were, you know, $80, $90 was pretty aggressive in some of the modeling, it seemed, and that was some of the numbers that were used. At the same time, price of gas was quite a bit higher too. So in reality, the parity was closer to 6-to-1. So it did make that break even seem a little more realistic at those prices. If you've noticed during some of the presentations we've made, we've been stretching the oil price certainly out to 200 and beyond in some of the presentations we made. So we've learned over the last 4 or 5 years that oil prices can go up exponentially. Nobody envisioned $140 certainly 5 years ago. So definitely a lesson learned in order to stretch out those prices a little bit when modeling these things.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bruce, I would really would like to see a couple charts, just plug them into your little scenario, and like one for 150 and one for 175, and then have gas being in the one around $3 and then in the other $8. Just to see, just so we'd have an idea in those two situations. So that would be four different scenarios?
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That'd be great.
Absolutely.
Thank
no
you.
Problem.
Mr. Tedger, is it possible, when you guys talk about modeling, you're essentially talking about the spreadsheet that does the calculations?
Yes, sir.
Is it possible to provide that model to us in a sort of a user-friendly way where members could manipulate their own parameters?
Co-Chair Feige, I know last year we did have a snapshot model that was available. I don't know if anybody requested it or not, but we have prepared models that we're able to turn over. Obviously, they don't have company-specific information, but we're able to turn over to legislators to let them
plug in any number to their heart's desire. So we'll look into that and see if any, if we have anything created already, or what kind of lift it would take to create something like that.
Among members of the committee, does that sound reasonable for you? Or? Yeah, if you could provide that to us, that'd be I think be good help. And give us something to do in the evening, shall we?
Slide 15, some observations. Decoupling provides for a state share similar to the status quo when gas prices are relatively high, therefore a less dilution of progressivity under status quo. Decoupling imposes a higher state share compared to the status quo when gas prices are relatively low. Decoupling generates revenue equal to or greater than oil standalone revenue in all cases. Slide 16, some issues with decoupling. Cost allocation is one of the biggest issues. How costs are allocated between oil and gas has a significant impact on overall taxes owed. Because oil and gas are generally produced together, it is not easy or straightforward to determine the cost applicable to the gas or oil produced. The cost allocation method could result in uncertainty, disputes, and delays. Cost allocation should be specified in statute and is a very important policy decision. Generally, when you're drilling a hole, both are going to be coming out of it. So how do you allocate the cost between the two products that are coming out of the same hole?
There is always oil and gas when an oil well is drilled, and right now oil is at $123, very profitable. Gas is, water is cheaper than gas at this point. But how do other states deal with that cost allocation between oil and gas? Just a couple different scenarios. How would Texas deal with that, where they have equal amounts of oil and gas, and how would some place like North Dakota, where they're producing lots of gas, or oil, I'm sorry, and not a lot of gas, how do they deal with the cost allocation?
Right. Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, this is in some ways a unique issue that's faced by jurisdictions that tax on a net basis. If you're taxing on a gross basis, the lease expenditures aren't even included in the calculation. But what we have found is for jurisdictions that do use a net basis and do have a separate tax system for oil and gas, gross value at point of production is the most common way of allocating costs between oil and gas. It's not the only way. I think our next slide goes into a couple examples of three of the most popular ways to do it.
Joe Gardner?
So how complicated would it be to use gross value at point of production here just for purpose of allocating costs and then retain the net profits tax system?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, any form of allocation under decoupling adds a layer of complexity to the tax. It would involve new statutes, probably new staff, new regulations, but it would be a hurdle that we could overcome.
Thank you.
Slide 17 shows three of the scenarios that Dan just mentioned. We look at oil, gas, and the total. So in the first couple lines, we talk about the production amount. The second line would be the gross value at the point of production. And we're using a parity of 15-1. So in the first scenario, we split the cost based on BOE, barrel of oil equivalent. And that would be 38% of the cost will go to oil, 63% will go to gas. So the total allocation would be a 1.875 versus 3.125. The total would still be 5,000. Scenario two would split the cost based on a gross value at the point of production. And you can see between the first scenario and the second scenario, they're flip-flopped almost. the 76% of the costs would be attributable to the oil, 24% would be attributable to the gas. In the third scenario, split based on assumed actual costs, would be 90% oil, 10% gas. And yeah, there's quite a different a big difference in the way you look at how costs could be allocated and split. So that's really one of the biggest issues to discuss when talking about decoupling is how we're going to allocate costs. Slide 18, we look at the impact of the allocation methods that were on the previous slide. So in the first bar chart, we look at decoupled with taxable barrels based on the BOE cost allocation format. And as you can see on the previous slide, that's where 38% of the costs went to the product that was worth a heck of a lot more than the gas. Oops. Therefore, the oil would be worth 6.8 and the gas would be worth 0.2. The gross value at the point of production is the middle bar, and that's a total of 5.9, 5.1 of which would be oil, 0.8 of would be gas. And then decoupled with oil costs at 90% and gas costs at 10%, we'd be looking at 5.5. And this is revenue generated to the state. So as you move more costs towards the higher priced product, you're driving down the PTV value that the tax is calculated on. One more time, as more costs are applied to the higher priced product oil, those costs are deductible, thereby bringing that PTV value down, and that's the number that the tax is calculated on. So if they don't get to deduct a lot of costs, the PTV is going to be a bigger number, and therefore there's going to be more progressivity applied to that number, thereby a larger tax take by the state. So as more costs are applied to the oil, it drives down the level of the PTV, thereby reducing the progressivity amount and the total revenue to the state. And as you can see, with all other things being held equal, we're looking at a $1.5 billion difference between the bar on the left and the bar on the right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, I understand what you just said. I hope I can hold on to it long enough to form this question. But the thought then is, but we're not just going to sign an arbitrary number. Isn't there some way to actually calculate, you know, how much is attributable to oil and how much is attributable to gas? We're not just, are we just looking for a number that suits us or doesn't suit us? We must be have to, when we ascribe the cost of production and compare those two, it has to be related to something in reality. It's not just like we're throwing a dart at a board.
Through the chair, Representative Dick, that's where when we go from the gross value at the point of production and start deducting the lease expenditures, that's where it gets complicated, because a well over here and a well over there could bring, this one could be 90% oil, 10% gas, and that one could be the reverse. Mm-hmm. So if it's being calculated on a gross level, all you're taxing on is the value of the product coming out, and you're thereby distributing your cost to the value. As soon as you go to the net system, you can do it in this way or any other way. There's no end to how you can actually apply these costs. So the trick is trying to decide the fairest way to allocate these costs. And again, you're trying to do it over a vast array of different if-then scenarios. And trying to put that in statute is where it gets very, very complicated. Dan, if you have anything to add that might help clarify, jump in.
I think the key was in the word fair, and I don't know how to legislate that, but that is the question, is it not?
Representative Wilson.
Okay, you're just going to have to say it again slowly. So the more of the costs are applied to the oil, does that mean the higher the cost of oil?
No, ma'am. Just the oil price is held constant in these scenarios. But the more the cost that's applied to the gross value of the oil.
Okay, so to the gross value.
I think we should go back to...
Right, so the basic principle of what's going on in these three graphs here is you have a situation where oil is pretty valuable and you're generating a significant progressivity surcharge on the oil, so you have a higher tax rate. Gas, there is no progressivity being generated on the gas portion of the sales under any of these three scenarios. So the more costs that get shifted to oil reduces the tax rate on the oil through the progressivity surcharge, whereas the more costs that get shifted to the gas give no benefit to the producer.
Okay. Now, so the more costs are applied to the gross value of the oil, it reduces the...
Production tax value and therefore reduces the progressivity surcharge.
Of the oil.
Correct.
Okay.
And so the bar on the left with the $7 billion has only 38% of the costs getting shifted to the oil, whereas the bar on the right has 90% of the costs applied against the oil. So you see the effect of shifting more costs towards the oil side reduces the overall tax liability. And this might be a good time to just clarify. There are some instances where a cost is going to be clearly an oil-only cost or clearly a gas-only cost, and those costs would still be applied against oil or gas. The allocation language applies to those situations where it's not clear, where you drill a well and both come out of the ground, and, well, what do we classify this $10 million as?
We, as the state, would want to calculate to see which scenario is best for us. We're, at the same time, the oil companies are doing the same thing to see what's its benefit to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no...
it's a tug of war.
Right, yeah. Chair? Mm-hmm. Because we choose which method they use. They don't get to choose it. That's a decision we have to make.
Right.
And that's why it matters, because we don't know which is always going to be the higher value and which is going to be the lower.
And is it fair to assume that depending on where a particular field is in its production cycle, whether it's at the very early stages or at the very latter stages, each of those methods are going to vary depending on, I guess, the degree of cost? And just later on, you're going to have more costs. Up front, you're going to have more costs. But in the middle, you're perhaps not going to have
a similar
set of costs.
I'd agree, Representative Feige, that we're looking at this as a point in time. But
right.
But a producer is going to be looking at the costs over an extended period of time, knowing that a natural decline in a well will require higher costs as the years go by to produce oil out of that well. So we're looking at it as a point in time, but they would look at it as a life cycle type.
Did you project. Go back and you kind of just you laid out what the three different allocation methods that you have there, but could you explain to the committee just the kind of the basic mechanics of each of those and that's less technical terms. You
want
to
go?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, the first method would be allocating costs based on barrel of oil equivalent. So this would be if you produce 10 barrels of oil and 10 barrels of oil. Well, in this example, you have 164 million barrels of oil and 274 million barrel oil equivalent of gas. It would be that ratio. The energy equivalent ratio of your production would be how you allocate the costs. The second example is based on the gross value at point of production. So this would allocate the costs based on the value as opposed to the energy equivalency. The third The third example is based on an assumed actual. So a company would say, oh, I spent my $5 billion. Well, $500 million of that was for gas. $4.5 billion of that was for oil. That would be probably the more complicated method of the three, because it would involve writing some complex regulations to define exactly how you'd come up with your actual costs for oil and gas in a situation like this. But that is a method that's used out there. And oil production is inherently more expensive than gas production in general. And so that's why we went with the 90-10. Another way that you could implement that type of allocation would be to specify a straight percentage. Specify that 90% of costs would go to oil when it needs to be allocated.
Which is the easiest for the department to administer?
Mr. Chairman, the first method, based on barrel of oil equivalency, is the method that is currently in statute. And doing it based on gross value at point of production would not be that hard of a lift. I think that any sort of method where you're deeming actual costs, like the third method, would probably get you into a much more complex situation.
Representative Gardner.
And that measure for the department, how does that translate for the producers? I mean, if something's the easiest for you to handle, does it follow that's the easiest for them, or not necessarily?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, I don't want to speak on behalf of the industry, but we're all tracking the number of barrels of oil and BOEs of gas and the value at the wellhead. So the first two would probably be the easier for them also.
Thank you.
I could see we're doing the actual method. Potential for a lot of arguments there, perhaps?
Correct.
Which entails a lot of lawyers, which entails a lot of time in a courtroom somewhere. So, Representative Dick.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you give me, I'm back on slide three. I'm trying. My question is, slide three. Based on the production tax value, is the market price, slide three,
mm-hmm.
market price minus transportation costs is equal to the GVPP. Got that. By transportation costs, we're referring then to the cost of getting out of the ground? What's the cost of getting out of the ground?
Representative Dick, through the chair, the transportation costs would be your TAPS tariff and the marine transport costs. So basically the cost to get it to market and the...
Then my question, thank you, and follow up. But my question is, where is the cost of getting it from its home to the wellhead?
Representative Dick, that'd be the second equation. The lease, that would be falling under the lease expenditures. So the cost to get it out of the ground would be considered
within the
lease expenditures. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
So your market price is at Cherry Point or Long Beach?
Mm-hmm.
Minus the cost of the tanker, minus the cost of tap. Mm-hmm. Okay, so essentially what it is at pump one. And then take that minus the lease expenditures that you had to spend to get it to pump one, gives you a PTV.
Thank you. I misunderstood lease expenditures.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, and just to clarify, when we're talking about cost allocation in this group of slides we just went through, that is referring just to the lease expenditures portion.
Slide 19, some other decoupling issues to consider. The potential impact on current gas production in Cook Inlet gas, gas used in state, small quantities of other gas production, OCS, outer continental shelf. Complexity of administration for state and the taxpayers. Specify gas tax now or save for another session. The balance between desire for revenue and making a major gas project attractive. and the treatment of net operating loss for gas.
Could you expand on that last one, the treatment of the net operating loss?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. That issue comes into play when you have a situation similar to current prices, where if you're selling gas for $2 to $3 at the market and paying a $4.50 tariff to get it there, your gross value at point of production is zero, and you're losing money just shipping the gas. Mm-hmm. And that's a policy call there on, do you want to offer some benefit for that loss? Because currently a loss due exclusively to transportation costs would not be eligible for a carry forward annual loss credit.
And this isn't necessarily the situation that a company would enter into, but this is something that, say, they expected the price to be at such a level, but it dropped, yet they were under contract to deliver the gas, right? Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Okay, so, for example.
Okay. I'm just trying to think of this in my head. That's why the companies want to own the pipeline, because they can pay that to themselves, which would, they can write off the loss that way and still make money. Am I thinking crazy, or is that true?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the $4.50 transport cost is a real cost. That's the cost of recouping their investment in building the pipe, maintenance of the pipe, et cetera.
But if they owned the pipeline,
it's still a realized cost that they're earning back through the tariff.
But they would be paying themselves.
They're not bringing in enough money to pay themselves.
Oh, okay.
Right, because the cost, the gas is only worth $2.
Okay.
The cost to get it to the market is $4.50. Okay. Regardless of who owns it, somebody's going to be paying that $4.50.
And so,
and the $2 is not going to be covering that off.
Okay. So, in reality, we have to decide whether we're going to pay him the difference or something?
Well, through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's the overriding discussion on a gas pipeline right now, is at $2.18 per, you know, it's a scary discussion to be having. A couple of years ago, when it was quite a bit more, it was a little more realistic discussion to have. So that's what the discussion's going to center around, is are you going to assume a gas price of X into the future and thereby making this pipeline economic, and what's the market, and there's a lot of big decisions that are going to be centered around this discussion, certainly. And it's a painful discussion to have when gas is at $2.18.
Yeah, the question of how you treat that net operating loss is, do you allow them to write it off against other production?
Correct.
Or do you say that you can't write off your operating losses? Point.
Would vastly change the economics of the way an investor is going to look at a project.
So what do other states do in the same situation? Well, they don't have this situation because they don't have as far to transport.
You beat me to the punch, Representative Wilson. That's what I was going to say. They don't have to deal with an 800-mile, 1,000-mile pipeline. Their markets and their pipelines are a lot shorter distances.
Thank you. I'm starting to wrap my head around this. My question is, I'm trying to picture a well, and a well where, you know, oil is coming out. And then, so gas and oil will be extracted simultaneously?
Yes, sir.
How tricky is it to extract that gas and oil simultaneously? Is that a difficult process? Because it seems to me if the gas is just waiting to come out anyway, so the cost of actually getting the gas out of the ground isn't probably negligible.
Through the chair, Representative Dick, at one time I had dreams of being an engineer, but I'm not going to venture down that road. I would leave that to DNR or maybe the producers, who could explain how they handle the product once it comes out of the ground and the ratios of the what oil gas mix is.
Think of it like a can of soda pop. You've got this gas, this liquid coming out of the ground, bubbles in it. And the, you know, depending on the how much gas content is in there, all you're doing is you're taking that mix that's coming out. You're separating the bubbles from the liquid. So in the end, you end up with a flat can of soda and a balloon filled full of gas.
Okay. But that's why what I'm looking for is what's fair. You know, what's fair? I mean, if the oil's coming out of the ground anyway, why not just describe all the cost of getting it out of the ground to oil? And if the gas is just coming out along with the again, we're looking for what's fair. Is that correct?
And through the chair, Representative Dick, not all wells are created equal. So if the same percentage of oil and gas was coming out of every single well, this would be an easy calculation. But there's different mixes, probably over a very wide range, over a varying timeline. It changes from, you know, back in the early 80s, they punched a hole and it was mostly oil coming out. And the cost was attributable to dealing with the oil coming out of the ground. The water and the gas were negligible. Today, it's the cost is attributable to dealing with the gas and the water, because there's a lot more of those products coming out of the ground than the oil. So that's where the cost is.
Thank you.
Yeah. Slide 20, we just a couple more slides. We talked briefly about the history of Senate Bill 305, which was the decoupling bill. From a couple sessions back, decoupled oil and gas for purposes of a major gas sale. The attempt was to solve the problem of flipping the switch. It held harmless most current gas production. It provided one tax calculation for oil, cook inlet gas, and gas used in state. It provided a separate tax calculation for non-cook inlet gas that is exported out of state. It's specified gross value at point of production cost allocation to the extent possible. Extensive analysis was done by the legislature, administration, and consultants. There were numerous technical issues raised and addressed. The final bill is the basis of this year's decoupling in Senate Bill 167, which was then folded into Senate Bill 192, which is in Senate Finance. So that just catches you up as far as what's sitting in Senate Bill 192.
When they use the quote "to the extent possible," what exactly does that? How does that fit in your three possible choices?
Thank you, Shetty Mike.
Right, Mr. Chairman. There, through the process of developing Senate Bill 305. In the initial versions, the lease expenditure allocation was left up to the discretion of the department through regulation. And we brought to the legislature's attention the major policy decision that was represented through the lease expenditure allocation. And so in the final version of SB 305, gross value at point of production was specified as the preferred method of lease expenditure allocation. They did include the language "to the extent possible," which would leave open, in theory, potential scenarios where another allocation method could be specified.
Okay. Now, that was up to the department then to assign a particular method if the first method was, for some reason, didn't work, or you weren't able to do it?
Right. So if you go into the language in the bill, it directs the department to develop regulations for the allocation of lease expenditures in those situations where it is necessary, mm-hmm. and then it directs the department to allocate lease expenditures based on the gross value at point of production to the extent possible.
Okay, so if they didn't have any production off a particular well, just in the production cycle, maybe they just drilled it and hadn't been able to connect it up, you would have different, you'd be able to adjust the tax rate on that somehow. It gave you some flexibility, basically.
it did give us more flexibility than a you will allocate based on this method period. But I think this is, there's a number of really technical points in the language of the bill, and this is one of those that we could be happy to meet and discuss.
Representative Dick, then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, and again, I'm trying to wrap my head around this. But right now what's happening is we're getting the oil out, and the gas is still coming out, and the water, and the mud, and the blood, and the beer. Okay, so they're still having to separate. So we're getting the oil off, and we're still having to separate the water and treat the water, and we're having to re-inject the gas again.
Correct.
So I guess my question then is, where's the cost if already we are doing all of that, given that all wells are not the same, that we're still dealing with all of those issues at every well, maybe a different percentage of each, but they are being treated and the gas is being re-injected.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just trying to understand then what's the difference between taking that final gas and re-injecting it and taking that final gas and putting it into our pipeline.
Through the chair, Representative Dick, I would defer to somebody who could talk about the engineering and the aspects of how the field's currently set up, knowing that they're looking for the oil, and that's the moneymaker right now for us and the producers. But that's the discussion going forward. What's the infrastructure going to look like if we do build a big pipeline with 4.5B? Obviously, that oil, they have the largest gas processing plant in the world on the North Slope because they're reinjecting almost 9 billion cubic feet a day back into the ground. And, of course, that's used to pressurize the well to get more oil out. So that's another part of the discussion, how much can be pulled off and still recover oil. So.
Thank you.
So the last slide we...
Wilson was next.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In this scenario with House Bill 05 that the governor vetoed, you guys would have been constantly kind of juggling things around trying to figure out how you were going to do it, right? I mean, how do you know when you're going to use, if you've got the flexibility to switch things around once in a while, then how do you know when you're going to do it? And so that does that mean somebody's constantly just checking on this stuff so that you know which ones you can do it with and which ones you can't? I don't quite understand it.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that during this time, we were already dealing with the most complicated oil tax structure in the world, or one of, certainly in North America. We were implementing upwards of 100 regulations, or in the process of just going through the PPT and ACES debates to deal with the oil side. This would then layer on another level of complexity. And the next slide, we do talk about the reasons why the governor vetoed the bill, but part of it wasn't quite right to be having this discussion to deal with the gas taxes. So it was trying to put in place a system for something that was still fairly far down the road. So we're catching up on the oil side, so I think now we're in a better position 2 years later to deal with this a little bit more. But again, it's speculation. We're talking about a gas sale that has yet to come to fruition. So if we'd already had a gas sale and we were talking about building another pipeline or something like that, it'd be a completely different discussion. But we have to assume quite a few things in order to start going down the regulation road in order to address the eventual gas sale.
Follow up with that.
And just let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Munoz. Representative Seaton has rejoined us. Follow up.
Okay, so you kind of, because you guys were still in pretty much flux trying to figure out ACES and how it was mm-hmm. going to work and everything, that you're probably glad that he vetoed it. But now you feel like you're ready to handle it and you can move forward if we do something, and we need to start thinking about what we're going to do in the future. Now, my question to you is this. Do you think it's better that we decouple right now so that the companies will know into the future when they go to an open season what to expect, or do you think we should wait until after the open season?
If I could go to the last slide, we actually talk about that a little bit. And this is a kind of a wrap-up of the history of what happened during that timeline. So it passed the Senate, it passed the House, the governor did veto it. The three reasons the governor cited in the veto message was decoupling on its own represented an overall tax increase. Changing the tax during the pipeline open season, the GE and Denali, created uncertainty. And again, we were right in the middle of that. So that's a large variable that is 2 years behind us now, and it's a different environment that we're talking about now. The third reason was change was not needed at that time because the legislature ultimately retains the ability to make changes to the tax laws. Therefore, any tax locked in for firm commitments at the first AGIA open season only applied to the gas, not the oil. So again, that I look at that as it wasn't the timing wasn't ripe in order to go down that road at that time, and that was the governor's three reasons for the veto. So now today, it's a different set of variables that we're looking at. These three concerns are still at the forefront of the governor's mind, obviously. That hasn't changed. That's why, while the language in SB 167, which was folded into SB 192, is identical to 305, if nothing changes, we still have a problem because the governor is still looking at some of these things as problems. But our thinking going forward is this is a people were familiar with 305. A lot of legislators had gone through that process. So as a point of starting this for this discussion, it seemed like an appropriate place to start, knowing that changes were going to be needed to that language in order to make it acceptable to all parties involved.
Representative Wilson.
I'm still going to ask the same question. and that question was, are we better off to make a decision now before open season starts, I know the governor's going to consider it an increase in taxes, and he's going to say that that's going to be a disincentive to the oil companies. I mean, that's where he's going to be coming from. I understand that. But setting that aside, when we're looking at, to be fair to the oil companies, wouldn't we be better off making the decision before the open season so they would know what they're dealing with in the open season rather than to wait until after the open season? If we wait until after the open season, do they say, well, we made the commitments in open season, and so we have to go by the old way?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there already was an open season that was opened and closed, so we don't know what the results of that were.
Yeah, no.
But going forward,
no, I know that that's over. I mean, we don't know what the results were, but
right,
we haven't heard anything fantastic, so we're guessing that it wasn't that great. Okay, but I'm talking about now the open season that if we have an open season, I think it's in October that they're thinking about. We'll start an open season, and that'll go into the first part of next year. So my question still remains, is it better for everybody concerned that they know something when they go into that open season? Or because to me, I would think, well, that uncertainty would make them hesitate to go into an open season. Tell me.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, certainly stability and knowing what the gas tax structure will look like will be a huge part of their consideration going down the road. I think what we're looking at today is we're willing to sit down and talk about putting a structure in place, not a tax system, but a structure in place in how to deal with decoupling these two products down the road. So the discussion that we would have in 192 this session isn't going to be the end-all, be-all, solve-all. It's locked in, and we're ready to go for the next 30 years. It's more putting the footprint in place in order to start dealing with the tax structure on gas next year or whenever that might be appropriate. So we're willing to talk about the language in SB 192, but it's not going to solve all the issues. There is going to have to be a discussion of the tax structure itself around gas.
Representative Wilson.
Okay, so I guess I'm confused a little bit here. Okay, so we're just going to say we're going to decouple. Is that what we're going to do? That's going to be, are we going to say how we're going to decouple, but we're not going to tell you what the numbers are?
Well, through the chair, Representative Wilson, I can only talk about what we know today. And what I know today is the language in SB 192 is the language that was SB 305, which was vetoed. So we don't know what that discussion is going to look like in the coming days or the weeks, or if we're going to have that discussion. We've heard from the other body that changes will be coming in a CS next week. So I think next week we might have a better idea, hopefully, of what that language looks like. But really, to speculate beyond that today, all I can address is what the language says today, and that's the language that was vetoed by the governor. So if nothing changes, we still have a problem. So before we see what the language says, it'd just be speculation on my part.
Okay. I still...
Okay, Representative Wilson.
I mean, because you said this would be just a footprint, and we still wouldn't have any numbers. So when we... whatever bill comes out, it probably won't have any tax structure itself in it or the numbers. It's just going to say we're going to decouple?
I don't know what's going to come out of that body.
Okay.
and one thing is when we talk about open season, you know, that's getting transportation commitments, but I think everybody's anticipation is those are contingent upon factors, so that's not generally assumed that those, not knowing whether it's going to be coupled or decoupled or what the tax structure is going to be, that people are going to give firm transportation commitments without a contingency for solving that problem or finding out what that is. So at least that's my expectation, is that someone isn't going to go in and say, I guarantee 30 years of shipping commitments no matter what the tax structure is, or no matter what the, you know, whether I get to take off my expenses from oil taxes and gas taxes, or all have to be segregated. Those, there's a whole lot of contingent things in probably. I mean, we haven't seen the bids, but I think most of the anticipation was they would be highly contingent bids, that if so and so and so and so, then we commit to doing something in the pipeline. Is that kind of your understanding, Deputy Commissioner?
I mean,
not that we know what those things are, but I mean, was that the anticipation by revenue and everyone else that open season commitments were going to be contingent upon other factors?
Mr. Chairman, I would prefer not to spec. I wasn't around during that time in this position, so I would rather not speculate on what the thought process was back then.
That's fine. Yeah, thank you. Further questions? And I'm sorry that I was over on the other side with the bill. I presume that you talked about, I think it's on slide 16, about cost allocation. Did you and it says cost allocation should be specified in statute and is a very important policy decision. Did you cover in your presentation kind of what some of those choices are?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we did. On slide 17, we laid out three different scenarios.
Okay.
Of one extreme to the other. And then the following slide, we showed the revenue impact to the state based on those three different scenarios.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll review those later, as well as the I can go back to the archive. Are there other questions? You mean it's all solved? Good. Well, I'm glad you got that figured out while I was gone.
We'll get it all solved on the Senate. Just shares it with us.
Please continue on our Senate bill.
And did you have anyone online that you wanted to bring into discussions that you haven't already? Like I said, I just got back. But
No, sir. I think they all got off the hook today. So
okay. are no further questions, and we'll be adjourned at 2:30, and we will look for Friday, HB 91, Management of Forest Resources, HDR 40, Rights of Ways, and bills previously scheduled.
Thank you.
Announced or scheduled.